I am excited to introduce our program today. You'll see at the end, it's interesting that I need paper to do it, but that's okay. But our program today is Dr. Sam Cotton, and she's a PhD and board certified practitioner in lifestyle medicine. She is also a faculty member at the Department of Family and Geriatric and Sports Medicine at the University of Louisville School of Medicine, where she works primarily at the Traeger Institute for Optimal Aging Clinic and the Family Medicine Residency Clinic at Marion Elizabeth. She is currently the director of the Alzheimer's Disease and Related Dementias Program as part of an HRSA-funded Geriatric Workforce Enhancement Program grant. In 2023, she also led a development team of an app for caregivers of persons with dementia called Flourishing Embrace, which provides family and unpaid caregivers with access to compassionate education tools and support. She's currently the president of the National Association of Geriatric Education. Samantha's married to our son, Bryce. And so we're really, really proud to call her our daughter-in-law. As my wife says, she's our daughter-in-love. And so, Samantha, we welcome you to Katie's for the program, and we thank you for coming.
Thank you all so much. I told him he didn't need to screw up that introduction. That could be a little awkward, right? I mean, come on now. I want to thank you all for having me out today. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about aging optimally, and this is one of my passions to talk about. And I'm actually going to share a little bit about myself as well as part of this conversation, because I think it's important for you to understand how I got involved in this work. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about where I actually work. I didn't hear any boos when I heard, you know, the introduction said I was from the University of Louisville, so I really appreciate that. Thanks. Thanks to all the UK fans for being compassionate towards me.
Go Cards.
Yeah, go Cards. Woohoo. So I mainly work out of our Traeger Institute. And if you've never heard of us, we're sort of a weird bird in the university system. We actually have an optimal aging clinic that is designed for individuals who are older adults to receive care. We do a lot of chronic care coordination with patients. We actually have a brain health clinic where we do assessments, diagnostics, testing for individuals who are concerned about their brain health. And then we also have a lot of community-based programs as well, where we have a virtual friendly visitor program for individuals who are living out in the community who might be lonely or need some additional support. We have about three different caregiver programs that I'm part of at the moment. And so those are all designed to help individuals who are caring for a loved one out in the community. So we do a lot of work in this aging space. And one of the things that, I'm going to skip over this, you all probably don't care about that piece. But one of the things that I wanted to share with you all today is how did I get into this world of optimal aging and this work. And this is something I am very passionate about. And part of it is because, and you heard when Norman introduced me, a lot of my work deals with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. And I don't know how many people here have had experiences maybe with a loved one or a friend who has dealt with that particular disease. I'm seeing some head nods. It can be very, very challenging. And this is a disease that has really impacted me almost my entire life, actually. So I'm originally from southeastern Kentucky. I'm from Knox County, Kentucky, if you've ever heard of there, almost in Tennessee, almost in Virginia, very rural part of the state. And when I was growing up, my mother worked during the day, and my father worked night shift, which meant that my care until I started school at 5 or 6 years old was provided by my grandparents. So every morning, my mother would get me up, and she would take me to my grandparents' house, which was really nearby, and they would take care of me while my mom was at work until she got off work. So I was very close with my grandparents, and in particular, my grandmother, who I just adored. She was one of those ladies who always had her hair done, always wore her little pearls and her cute little dresses, and she was always in charge. She was the person in our family who, like, you know, if she said something, you did it, right? You didn't question it. She was just that person. So kind of larger than life to me as a child. And when I was about 6 or 7 years old, she got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom or get a glass of water or something, and she fell and actually broke her hip. As a result of that, she obviously went to the hospital. They did surgery. She had to go to rehab for a while, was still not able to walk, was pretty much confined to a bed or a wheelchair. They ended up deciding to do a second surgery, so she went back to the hospital for that, then went back to a rehab facility. And during all of this, this was over about a 6 or 7 month period of time, and during all these sort of transitions from home to the hospital to the rehab facility, we started noticing, even myself at 7, that something wasn't quite going on well with her. She was having a lot of memory issues. She didn't remember those of us who she saw every day. She started calling me, I think it was Robert or Bob. I did have a short little haircut. And she definitely could not remember my name was Sam. And I was, you know, she had been taking care of me this whole time, right? So she, you know, this was kind of concerning to everybody. She began getting very combative. And so during the course of all of those transitions, we found out that she had Alzheimer's disease. So she was officially diagnosed with that. Now, this was the early 90s in rural southeastern Kentucky. My family could barely pronounce the word Alzheimer's disease, much less did we know what we were supposed to be doing in terms of her care. So I watched as my mother would get home every day. I should also say we moved my grandmother back home to provide care to her. She was never able to walk again. And my mother would get off work every day about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and she would spend all evening with my grandparents taking care of my grandmother, and then get, you know, take me home at bedtime, and then we'd get up all over again the next day and do it again. And I saw the toll that took on her. My grandmother had a lot of hallucinations. She would see people who weren't really in the room with her. She was very combative. If she didn't like something, she was still she was about 6 feet tall and very, very strong, despite not being able to walk. She would, you know, swing a punch at you. One time she got an infection during the course of all this, and we ended up, she had to go to the hospital again. And as part of that, she had a complete episode. They had to restrain her in the hospital. And when they went to give her the injection of the medication to calm her down, she actually grabbed the needle and stabbed the provider in the face with it. So she was, you know, not an easy person to take care of. So I, you know, growing up, these were some of my first memories, right? And they were particularly, you know, scary a little bit. As I got older, we had other family members who had all dementia. Actually, an aunt who came to live with us when I was about 9 or 10 who had dementia. This was all on my mother's side of the family. On my father's side of the family, I had several family members who had dementia as well. So fast forward, I start working in social work, and I think, what am I going to do with my life? Well, I've really been informed by a lot of these family experiences, right? And I want to do something. So when I went back to get my PhD, my entire research was all focused on how do you take care of a person with Alzheimer's disease? How do you work with an individual when they are seeing things that aren't there? Or they have repetitive behaviors that you don't know how to deal with, right? So I developed a curriculum, a training program for family caregivers, but also for nursing aides and other staff in nursing facilities. I spent a lot of time investing in research in this space. I'm very involved in trying to figure out, you know, what are these different things that I can do research on that can be helpful. And something during this whole process for me, and again, I started this like over 10 years ago doing this work, and I've had a lot of great successes in this space, right? The curriculum that I created for nursing facilities is used across the state of Kentucky now. So I'm very proud of that. But something still bothered me about this. And part of it was I was looking at my family and thinking, wow, I hope that doesn't happen to me. But at this juncture, I probably had 8 or 9 family members that I could count on one hand that I knew that I had taken part in their care from the time I was 7 years old who had some type of dementia. And so I started doing a little bit, taking a step back and saying, okay, you know, what can I do to take care of myself? What does this look like? Because at this point, I'm thinking, I've got this genetic risk. I am going to get dementia. I had one of my very close friends and my colleagues, around the same time I'm kind of grappling with all of this, her father passed away from Alzheimer's disease, and she is originally from South Africa. And so she starts getting these same worries, and she's at this juncture, I'm about 34, 35, so it's 5 or 6 years ago, and she's about 58. So we're both like, oh, what are we going to do about this, right? We're particularly nervous about the whole situation. So we decide we're going to go get tested. We're going to do the genetic testing for Alzheimer's disease. And she only has this one person in her family who has dementia. I have like 8 or 9 people, as I've already told you. So I'm like, it's definitely coming back. I've got a genetic predisposition for this. So we go together. We get tested. Hers comes back first. And she finds out that, and just to give you a quick kind of biology lesson, when you have a genetic predisposition for things like dementia, you get one, what we call an allele from your father and one allele from your mother, right? So it's about 50-50, you're getting it from each parent. And so when you do the genetic testing, we have different kind of categories that we say to kind of determine your risk for this. It doesn't mean you're going to get dementia, it just means that you have a higher than normal risk factor at getting dementia. So hers comes back and she has what we call allele 4-4, which means that she has 75% chance of developing dementia before she's around 75, right? Okay, so she's only had this one person in her family who's had dementia so far. I'm like, well, look at me, I'm going to have this, right? My testing comes back and I find out I have allele 2-2. Do you know what that means? That means I have a genetic protective factor against dementia, right? Okay. So I'm shocked. I'm floored because this doesn't make sense. On both sides of my family, I have all these people who have dementia. And so I'm like, what? How is it that she has this and no one else in her family has Alzheimer's disease, right? And so we start comparing. I grew up in a very rural area where I do not remember my parents ever working out. I don't remember coming from a family where we, you know, no one ran, no one swam, except for myself growing up. We didn't eat healthy. I don't remember eating a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables growing up, quite frankly. We ate a lot of McDonald's. I don't remember, I come from a whole line of chronic insomniacs, where people just in my family do not sleep well. It's always a struggle. And so I started thinking about that, and I'm like, we have this protective factor, and we're not even tapping into it here. We are actually harming ourselves over time. And whereas my friend, my colleague, is originally from South Africa, and she grew up eating a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, not necessarily eating meat at every meal. She was outside a lot. They just naturally, they weren't exercising per se, but as part of their normal routine, they were moving their bodies a lot, right? And they really focused on things like sleep and stress levels. And so what this did for me was really take me down this kind of pathway of thinking about how do I kind of take all of this information and think about ways that I can better myself. So this really was a personal mission at the end of the day. And I started doing some preliminary research in the beginning, thinking, how am I going to take care of myself? What's this going to look like? And all of that. And if you Google brain health or Alzheimer's disease and preventing it, you're going to get so much information. And I was so overwhelmed because I was sitting here thinking, okay, I've got to do something to better take care of myself. And just look at this. I mean, this is just from yesterday. I Googled a couple of these things. Glaucoma medication may help prevent Alzheimer's disease. Sleep apnea, if you treat that, it'll help your Alzheimer's disease risk. A probiotic drink, kefir, if you've ever heard of that, can help with Alzheimer's disease risk. We're so inundated with information. And so when I started this journey of thinking about taking care of myself, I was like, what am I going to do? There's all this information. It's not, you know, realistic in my day-to-day life to think about all these different interventions that's being pushed to me. And that's what brought me to what we call lifestyle medicine. And so I started learning more about some of the principles related to lifestyle medicine. And this is really a way to think about how do we age optimally? So I did a lot of research in this space. I actually went and got board certified as a practitioner in lifestyle medicine so I could learn more about some of these things I'm telling you about today. And one of the things when I go out and do these types of talks about optimal aging or brain health that I often hear is, what can I do to take care of my brain as I age? That's one of the top questions. about once a year, I get tapped into a radio show or our local news channel is WHAS in Louisville. They want to have me on, and they want me to just to come in and talk about lifestyle medicine or brain health specifically. And I'll get all these questions about what can I do? How can I not get dementia? What's the magic, you know, pill here that I can take? And I always tell people that, you know, it's so interesting because last time I checked, our brains, our heads, were still connected to the rest of our body. So that's why you really have to take a sort of holistic approach to taking care of yourself. It's not magic. It's not rocket science. And so those things that we do to take care of our bodies as we get older are going to naturally be helpful for us in terms of preventing things like Alzheimer's disease and helping us just in general maintain that resilience that we need as we get older. As we get older, and I'm not going to bore you with the science, although this is quite fascinating stuff for any of you all who are into this. As we get older, there's a lot of things that are happening in our bodies. We tend to have issues with immunity, meaning we're more prone to infections. As we get older, what we often see is the proteins, which are like that building block of life within our body, they tend to have issues multiplying and dividing in ways that are reasonable within our body. So that's where we see things like Alzheimer's disease manifest as well. We're exposed constantly to a lot of things like pollution, radiation, all of these things that are in the world, whether or not we know we're exposed to them, that can cause us to have stress inside the cells within our bodies, which, again, as we get older, we're a little bit less able to tolerate those things. We also have issues with just from a metabolism standpoint, the nutrients that we get from our food, it's a little bit more difficult for us to get everything that we need in at certain times because we have what we, essentially what happens within our bodies is we kind of need more nutrient-dense food. So sometimes eating the things like McDonald's, not going to be helpful because we're not going to get necessarily the nutrients that we need. So again, not to bore you with the science, but this is complex stuff that's happening within each and every body as we get older. And to put it in layman's terms, what happens is from the minute we're born, we start building up these processes. We build up resilience to all of these different things. And at a certain point, we kind of hit a peak, right? It's kind of like it for any of you who've ever been runners. You get to that point in running where your endorphins just kick in and you just keep going, right? If you've ever had that experience, that's kind of how our bodies tend to work, right? So I often equate it to playing Jenga. Right from birth, we start building all these different building blocks of our bodies and our systems, and they're all very much interconnected. But as we get older, we have these natural changes that happen. And so it's like slowly, when you're playing Jenga, think about that, you pull blocks out, right? And eventually you get to a point where things topple over. And that's where we see that there are some challenges. Now, if you've ever played Jenga, just to keep on this analogy here, this visual image, there are things you can do to make your structure a little bit more sturdy, right? So that you're not just randomly pulling out those slides and it topples over very quickly. And that same goes for our bodies as well. So we have to sometimes be very strategic in the ways that we take care of ourselves to kind of negate or postpone some of these natural processes that are happening for us. But in, I would say, in our country, we tend to do a lot of things that make our little body Jenga structure a little bit less stable. And these include things like tobacco use, poor nutrition. Notice I don't use diet, and we'll get to that in a second. I have a whole thing on that. Physical inactivity. We don't move our bodies like we used to, right? We tend to drive everywhere. And then excessive alcohol consumption. And this is something you may have seen on the news as well. In terms of alcohol misuse and overindulgence in alcohol, and individuals, we're now seeing even in much younger groups of individuals, cancer risk as associated with them drinking too much. So all of this tends to contribute to us not being able to, you know, have that resilience, build up that strength against some of these natural things that are happening for us. And so that's a lot of what I want to talk to you about today, is that there's not really a magic pill, right? When we start talking about optimal aging or even brain health specifically, I know that there's a lot of magic things that are kind of touted in the news. And I always tell people, be weary of that. Be weary of somebody telling you that one pill will solve all of your problems. Because when you start talking about your body, it's such a complex system, as I've already told you, that a lot of times what happens is one little thing is not going to be that helpful in the grand scheme of things, quite frankly. And so it's really important for us to think more about how we're taking care of ourselves as a whole. And that's where I call, we often call this lifestyle medicine. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the pillars of lifestyle medicine. But to me, it's about getting back to the basics. Again, it's not what I'm telling you today is not rocket science. It's probably things you've heard before throughout your life. And some of it you might already naturally be doing as well in some of the areas of your life. But in general, we talk about nutrition. We talk about healthy sleep. Quality sleep. We talk about physical activity or movement, healthy relationships or social connections, the importance of stress reduction, and avoiding excessive use of risky substances. So those are things like alcohol and tobacco. And so again, getting back to the basics can be very helpful for us as we get older. It can also, from a preventative, for those of you, I see a lot of younger people in here today, for those of you who are much younger, thinking about these things now can be so helpful for you in the future. You know, I always laugh because I do work in the care of older adults. And a lot of times people think you turn this magic number of 65 and then it's time to start taking care of yourself. And I always say, no, no. When we talk about optimal aging, we really should be talking to you when you're in your 20s, when you're in your 30s, definitely by the time you're getting into your 40s. Because the things that you do much younger can help now. Now, that doesn't mean if you've done none of these things that we're going to talk about today, you can't start now no matter what age you are. But we know that there's more positive benefits if you start much younger. So tell your kids and your grandkids too. I think that's an important part of this. So I'm going to start by talking about nutrition. Now, again, notice I say the word nutrition. I don't say diet, right? And I think that we, over time, have kind of conflated these two things. And to me, nutrition is very different than all of those fad diets that you'll see touted in the media. I remember when I was growing up, my mother, you know, she tried every fad diet there was. I remember books on Atkins, all these books on, you know, keto type diets. You know, those are very popular now, but they were a thing way back when as well. And so unless this is going to jumpstart your kind of nutritional journey, my problem with doing these diets is they're, what, very restrictive. A lot of times you're only allowed to eat certain things, certain times of the day. And they really take the joy out of eating, right? And to me, food is one of those most basic human rights and privileges that we have. A good meal with good friends or good family has, I think, the true power to cure you of whatever ails you. And it doesn't have to be a physical ailment. Sometimes it's the social component of connecting with someone else. We're all here today and we shared a meal earlier, right? And you got to talk to the people at your table and spend that time with them. And so when we start talking about diets, I think a lot of times people feel like they can't engage with food in that way. And so that is so problematic. Just in terms of, you know, that connection sometimes that we have to food. And actually, one of my first memories growing up is related to food. I told you already that I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and one of my first memories of growing up, I could have been more than 3 years old. My grandfather was kind of a little mover and shaker in town, and so all of the older men in our hometown, about 10 to 15 of them, would come to his house every morning for coffee, and he would make biscuits with red eye gravy, if you've ever had red eye gravy. Not the healthiest choice, but is it tasty, right? And so I remember, you know, he had one of those hand crank sifters for the flour, and he would let me, like, help him make that. And again, I still remember what the biscuits smelled like and the gravy smelled like, and drinking the coffee with him. I would get to dip my biscuit in the coffee, and all these, you know, it was just me and about 15 older men, and they would talk about politics and news and stuff like that. And it was just, it's such a formative kind of memory for me that I associate food and eating and the social aspect with that. And so I think nutrition is really, really important, but I think we need to avoid these fad things. And that's also what I'm talking about in terms of getting back to the basics. So in lifestyle medicine and within optimal aging, when we talk about nutrition, we're really talking about a balanced food plan for yourself. It doesn't mean being restrictive. We're talking about whole plant-based, predominantly, that type of food. Now, I'm not telling you can't eat meat, because I think that's restrictive. But I do think we also need to focus on having a well-rounded plate in front of us. I was telling Norman while we were sitting there, I was like, make sure you eat your broccoli. And broccoli is one of those, what I call a superfood. It actually, per calorie, has more protein in it. So if you think about calorie to calorie, more protein in it than having a steak. Because you have to think about the how heavy a steak is in terms of calories. And so you're doing yourself a world of good by eating broccoli. Protein is actually something that fills us up. So a lot of times people who tend to try to incorporate more fresh fruits and vegetables into their nutritional plan or their normal eating plan think, oh, I'm still hungry, right? So it's important for you to look for foods like broccoli that have more protein in them, because that helps you feel fuller and it sustains your energy levels for longer. So again, when we talk about nutrition, we're talking about, again, going back to the basics. And eating foods in their natural state as well. This is also why I don't tend to recommend, like, all the vegan burgers that's like fake meat. And that's because a lot of times, unless you're making those at home yourself, heavily processed, right? And you're getting a lot of stuff in those that you don't necessarily need. So it would actually, in that situation, be better to, you know, get your beef from a local farmer and eat the hamburger versus, you know, eating a lot of that pre-processed stuff. When we talk about nutrition as well, I always like to say food is medicine, right? Because what we put into our body, we reap the benefits of that for a much longer time than we actually think. When we focus on nutrition and focus on taking care of ourselves in this way by eating food, no worries at all. It not only helps us with, you know, just feeling better, but it can do things like reduce inflammation that we're dealing with in our bodies. It improves our heart health. It helps regulate our blood sugar levels. A lot of times when we eat a lot of processed foods, what happens is processed foods tend to have a lot of additional sugars in them. So what we see is a spike in our blood sugar levels. And then later in the day, we're feeling a little fatigued. We're feeling tired. We don't feel so good. So that's why I always say, if you want to know what's best for you and your body, think about it this way. Eating the apple, better than eating applesauce. Unless you were at home blending that apple yourself and not adding extra sugar to it, go look next time you go to the store at applesauce. There's a lot of extra sugar that is added to those types of things. So unless you really can't chew the apple, and then I suggest, you know, let's blend it up or do something a little bit different with it at home, eat the apple versus the applesauce. So it's about eating those things in their most basic state. And again, I'm very passionate about nutrition just because I feel like A lot of times what we are getting told is do this, do that, and it kind of ignores common sense at the end of the day. And when you're talking about food, we really just need to go back to the basics on that. So moving from nutrition and thinking about how important that can be, physical activity or movement is also a key component of optimal aging. And when we talk about physical activity, we're talking about regular exercise, right, or regular movement. I want to tell you that a lot of the guidelines generally recommend at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity every week. When we talk about moderate intensity, you might be thinking, well, what's that mean? That is where you can jog at a pace and still talk, right? And yeah, you might be breathing a little heavy, but you can still say something. So it's not the intense exercise that sometimes, you know, where you're completely out of breath and you can't say anything to anyone. Now, I don't know how many people are doing this, right? Probably not a lot of people. This is the one that usually gets me laughed out of the room, right? What I recommend is that if you're not doing anything, something's better than nothing. So even if you're just doing 10 minutes of something every day, that is way better than you sitting on the couch just watching TV, just because you're doing something to move your body. And our bodies are naturally meant to be in motion, right? We are not meant to be sitting in front of a computer all day, which is what I have to remind myself when I'm sitting at my computer all day at work. I love when I get to go out and do this because at least I'm standing. In general, you know, this is so important in terms of just your overall health. Not only does it help with cardiovascular health, respiratory health, muscles, maintaining those muscles, that muscle strength as you get older, but guess what? It also helps with brain health. Actually, there's been quite a few very large-scale research studies that have been done recently in the last 2 or 3 years that says if you're going to pick one thing to do for brain health and forget if you're not going to get, you don't have time for anything else, you can't be bothered with anything else, move your body because that has the most impact on your overall brain health. Now, in some situations, some of us are in we might not be able to run or even go for a walk for one reason or another. And I always want to tell people that is okay. There are other ways that you can move your body. Chair-based yoga is a really great way for you to move your body, especially if you're not able to, you know, get out and, you know, do your steps, do that sort of thing. The other thing...
I'm having trouble hearing you. Oh.
Oh, my phone has tapped into something. Well, she was listening. Hope you all were. The other thing I want to say about exercise or physical activity is that we also know that it improves your mood. So if you're feeling a little down in the dumps, instead of sitting with that, sometimes getting out there and moving can be so helpful. Exercise produces something called endorphins in our body, and endorphins are like the happiest of the happy pills that occur naturally for you. So if you're feeling down in the dumps, you're feeling depressed, go take a walk. It can just change your mood just like that. It also helps with things like sleep, reduces our risk for different chronic conditions, and just helps us in terms of feeling good, feeling overall fitness. It makes us feel good. And again, I want to say that I'm not asking you to go run the marathon, but get started, do something, move your bodies. I think there's just so much power in that. And go with a friend. Sometimes getting out, going to the park. I hear you all have a wonderful disc golf place to go play here. Get out there and do that. That's moving, right? And if you make it a social thing, you're a little bit more apt to sort of keep doing it over time, which can be so helpful. The other thing I want to share with you is it's never too late to start. So this picture is of a 93-year-old. He lives in Ireland. And He had never really worked out, never really done any type of physical activity. He had retired and was looking for something to do. And he is 93 now, didn't start, he's rowing here, if you can't see the picture really well, it's a little blurry. Started rowing when he was 70. And is so fit now that he's actually part of a research study that's being done in Ireland. And they determined that from a physical standpoint, his body is more like a 40-year-old than a 93-year-old. And again, he did not start, he didn't even get on a rower until he was 70 years old. So it is never too late to reap the benefits of that. And from a, so this is like when we talk about him being like a 40-year-old, it means like his body, like if you were to do not just blood work, but at a very cellular level, he doesn't present as a 93-year-old. We don't see some of the same markers that we would expect to see in him at this moment. So you should look him up. If you just Google 93-year-old rower, it'll pop up articles about him. But again, he didn't start this until 20 years ago when he was 70. So it's pretty remarkable what our bodies are capable of. If we really just make a little bit of an effort and start doing something. And then sleep. So I told you I came from a long line of insomniacs, people who would stay up all night. I remember my father always worked night shift, so he was just always up at night. All of his family members on that side of the family, they're traditional, like your classic 2 a.m., 3 a.m. night owls, and then they get up at like 6 or 7 in the morning because they didn't sleep in. So we're talking lack of sleep. I have struggled with this in the past as well. And I will say that in general, when we talk about sleep, what we're talking about is quality, uninterrupted sleep for at least 7 hours. That is usually our magic number for sleep. Some of you are laughing, which makes me think you're not getting 7 hours. Yeah. Now, I've had people tell me that, you know, oh, I only need 4 hours or I only need 5 hours. That's how it always has been in my family. I will tell you, think about your body as a computer or your phone, all right? Sometimes your phone doesn't work right. Your computer don't work right. What do you got to do? You got to restart it, right? That's what sleep does for our bodies. I'll tell you, I do a lot of statistics, a lot of math as part of my job and part of research. And sometimes I will be at the computer at like 10 or 11 o'clock at night, unfortunately, trying to figure out the puzzle that is my data. And I will sit there and I will stare at it and I will fuss with it. I'll rearrange it. I'll try to impose it in different ways. I'll try different tests. And, you know, a lot of times it just means I'm not meeting when it's not working out or I'm getting errors, it means that I've done something wrong. It's not usually the data's fault. It's usually my fault. And I'm not meeting the assumption of that test that we're supposed to run within that thing. Not to bore you with statistics details. But if I just pack it away and shut my computer down and go to sleep, I will wake up in the morning and the puzzle will have been solved. I will magically, and it's because I got too tired, right? And I'm sitting there just spinning my wheels trying to figure this out, this little puzzle out. So what I'm trying to tell you is that a lot of times getting sleep helps us reset. It can also be very helpful in terms of our cognitive functioning as well. Think about when you don't get enough sleep. You feel a little groggy, you feel a little moody, you feel a little tired, right? You're not functioning, you know, at that top level. And so it can be so important for us to do that. And I will tell you, she's probably going to start listening to me again, but these things are the worst things for our sleep. These things, TVs, worst things for our sleep. Do you know why? Anybody know why? Blue light, yes. So the blue light that emits from our devices is so, it can have, you know, our bodies were not, we went hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years without these tiny little devices emitting all of this light. But, excuse me, we were not meant to be looking at these things before we tried to go to sleep. I always recommend that people put away their phone, turn off the TV, maybe pick up a book or a magazine about 30 minutes before you're trying to actually go to sleep. Okay. Because that can help you kind of reset. It gets you away from that screen time. Whether you're aware of it or not, that screen time can have impacts on you in the middle of the night. So a lot of times what it does is it messes with our natural rhythm, that exposure to that light. There was actually a research study done last year, or maybe it was 2 years ago now, where even just a small sliver of light coming into our bedrooms at night, whether it be from just a street lamp or something of that sort, whether or not we are aware of it and it wakes us up, it is waking us up and has a problem. It contributes to us not sleeping so well. So I always recommend people get into a routine. Figure out what that looks like for you, and put yourself to bed. Much like when you were a kid, your parents put you to bed, right? And there was a routine. Figure out what that routine looks like for you. I try not to look at my phone for at least 30 minutes. In my ideal world, it's an hour, but sometimes not realistic. I get those late night emails. And so making sure you're not paying attention to your phone, maybe playing something soothing if you have a device where you can play music. For a lot of individuals, decreasing that stress and getting ready for bed is also tied to smell or scent. So looking into things like diffusers with essential oils that are relaxing, all of those things. But going through that routine can be very helpful for you in terms of just getting into that good sleep pattern. So sleep, very important. And then avoidance of risky substances. Now, I mentioned earlier that over or misuse of alcohol has, in recent years, we've seen a lot of a rise in terms of things like colon cancer, for example. And we're sort of starting to see that there's some trends there where individuals excessively use alcohol as being a contributing factor. Even in age categories, much younger age categories, where we did not see things like colon cancer previously. So this is a huge deal. A lot of times, I also see that it's not just excessive alcohol use, but when we think about risky substances and just that impact on long-term health, sometimes over-reliance on those medications we've been prescribed can be a problem. And a lot of times for us, it's not that we purposefully do things like that. It's that sometimes we're looking to sort of self-soothe, right? We're looking to sort of dull that pain that we're feeling. Sometimes it's not, I'm not even just talking about physical pain, and I know some of us might have chronic pain that we're trying to get rid of from a physical standpoint, but sometimes things like loneliness, grief, I think back, none of us are having to wear masks here today, right? But we just went through a global pandemic, right, of historic proportions. We lost a lot of loved ones during that. We lost sort of our sense of being able to do things for a long time that were seemingly normal. And so that has an impact on us from a mental health perspective. And so sometimes what we're doing these things, again, it's more deep-seated than, on when you first glance at it. And so understanding that and trying to work through those things and talk about them if you're having those challenges can be really, really important, because we know that a lot of these substances, while they do dull the pain, they're not necessarily going to help us long-term. And while I'm on the topic of mental health, the last two things I'm going to talk to you about are very much interconnected between our physical health and our mental health. And when we talk about optimal aging and we talk about really sort of better managing our overall health, I think it would be remiss for us to ignore our feelings, right? I'll say this, and I'll keep it a little brief because I know I'm running out of time, but really that interaction between mental health and physical health is so interconnected. When you're physically feeling well, a lot of times you mentally feel well, right? And vice versa. So we call that a bi-directional relationship, where those things really have a impact on us. And I always like to say, I teach a lot of family medicine residents in the work that I do. And, they're the future doctors of the world. They're still learning, even though they finished medical school and they're getting additional training. And a lot of times patients come in and
They're depressed. They're anxious. They've got a lot going on, a lot of stressors in their life. And my residents will say, well, I'm just a doctor. I don't touch that. And it's like, come on, guys. This, anything you're feeling, this is all connected to the rest of you, and it's going to have an impact. So, you know, that is one of those things where I think we can't ignore it. It's just part of our overall physical health. So when we talk about optimal aging, one of the things is stress management. Everybody has something going on, right? I can't think of anybody I know in my life who doesn't have some sort of stressor in their life. It would just be very, very, very rare for you not to have something. Now, I do think that there are things we can do to sort of decrease those stress levels. And one of my chief complaints is that you might hear people talk about self-care, right? I love that word. I like to take care. I like myself. I like to take care of myself. What I hate about that is it's been, that term has been really co-opted and commercialized by big business here in this country, where we're told you have to buy this app to be taking care of yourself. You have to take that vacation to the beach to be taking care of yourself. You have to, buy this notebook and journal in it. That's how you take care of yourself. You're told, you know, this is what self-care looks like. Well, I'll tell you, a lot of those apps and those vacations, they seem real expensive to me. I don't know about you all. There's got to be a better way. So one of the things I always suggest that people do is really try to figure out, what is it that brings you joy? And it can be something that is 10 minutes of your day. But you need to do it every day. Self-care is not the trip, I hate to tell you. That can be part of it, you know. But you really need to find something that you do each and every day that really sparks that joy for you. For me, quite frankly, it's painting, right? I really enjoy painting. If you give me 5 minutes of my day and I just get to put some paint on a canvas, I am happier than a lark. But for everybody, you have to kind of figure out what that means for you, right? And figure out what that is. And it doesn't have to be something elaborate. It can be going and sitting outside in peace by yourself for 10 minutes. It can be going for a walk with a friend. It could be, you know, spending that time with yourself reading. So again, it's going to look very different for every person. But we have to find these ways to manage our stress. I know for a lot of people, has anybody ever heard of mindfulness meditation? Okay, a couple people shaking their head. That's a really great strategy that really helps you clear your head, really kind of recenter, focus on your breathing. That's been very popular in recent years. I'll go ahead and tell you, I'm not great at that. Just sitting and trying to focus on my breathing. I'm one of those people, I like to be moving. I like to be doing something, right? So again, it's about finding, don't let other people tell you what self-care looks like for you. It's about finding what works for you. When we do focus in on taking care of ourselves and reducing our stress, we see not just impacts in our mental health, things like depression or anxiety that we might be feeling, but also things like blood pressure. It really helps with that. It can also just help us build up what I call that resilience to be able to deal with other things that are going on in our life, right? We have a little bit more, our battery is charged, so we're able to sort of better take care of other things in our life. And then last but not least, when we talk about some of these other mental health related focused areas that are part of optimal aging, healthy relationships or social connection. I like to call this healthy relationships because sometimes we all have that family member that we just stresses us out, and it's not a really healthy relationship. And so having those positive social connections in our life is so important from, humans are very social beings in general. Even if you're kind of a shy, introverted person, having at least one other person in your life that you can go to and have that relationship with and talk to is so important. It gives us this sense of feeling of, or the sense of belonging to something. And so participating in social gatherings like this one today, going to church, going on outings with friends or family, all of that is so important. not just for our sense of, you know, well-being, but also just that feeling of belonging. We all want to belong to something, right? And so that, again, can also help with your stress levels, having a person to talk to share things with. It also reduces our risk for depression and anxiety. A lot of times it also helps us achieve our goals. For example, if you have a friend who you meet a couple times a week and you go for a walk, right? That's getting that exercise, that movement piece. You're holding each other accountable, but you're also getting that positive, healthy relationship as well with that individual. And I think I'm going to skip that and just remind you that, again, the basics. When we talk about optimal aging, we talk about lifestyle medicine, we talk about brain health, whatever you want to call it, there is no magic pill that's going to, like, solve all these problems. It really is about us taking care of ourselves and thinking about the whole picture. And getting back to those basics, really focusing in on those things that we know how to do. It's just about doing them. So I would like to encourage all of you today, pick one area of your life. Come up with a goal for yourself and make that happen. Our goals are only so good as us actually doing them, right? So maybe even pick a buddy who's here today and tell them what your goal is. And then hold each other accountable. Check in with each other on those goals. Because that's really the key to all of this. There is no magic to it. So that's all I have. I think we have a little bit of time for questions, if people have questions. Yes.
I have one.
Yes.
Can you tell me exactly how you feel if you've got a family member that is showing signs of dementia or if they're showing signs of Alzheimer's?
Okay. Great question. Did everybody hear that? So she's asking how you can tell if you have a family member who's showing signs of dementia or showing signs of Alzheimer's disease. Let me step back and just tell you that when we talk about Alzheimer's disease and dementia, a lot of times we use those words interchangeably, so it can be very confusing, right? And let me step back and tell you that dementia is really our umbrella term for about 100 or so conditions that all deal with memory loss. And Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia. There are other types of dementia you might hear about, like vascular dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, Parkinsonian type dementia. So again, dementia is sort of our umbrella term. And Alzheimer's disease is one type. You most commonly hear about Alzheimer's disease because when we do studies on the numbers of people who have Alzheimer's disease, the prevalence rate shows us that of all people who have dementia, about 60 to 80% have Alzheimer's type dementia. So that's why you often hear that interchangeably. So when you go, if you have somebody in your life that you're concerned about, who's presenting with memory loss, I'll tell you that a lot of times it's not, memory is not the first thing we often see with everybody. Right. Sometimes we see challenges where individuals have trouble with what we call critical thinking. So maybe they can't do two-step sort of things in their life. Like maybe they can put the shirt on, but they can't remember to button it. Right. They can remember how to go to the restroom, but they don't remember the washing the hands part. Or they can't balance. This is going to really date me. Checkbook. They can't balance their checkbook anymore. Right? Or even if they're getting online and trying to do it, they can't do that. So a lot of times we see that first, right? And then memory slowly starts to go. Now, if you notice that you have a loved one who's struggling with this, I often say, you know, I probably lose my car keys about 5 times in a day just because I'm busy and I'm out and all those things. That's not really a sign. Losing something like that is not a sign of dementia necessarily. It's if I was looking for my car keys and I found them and I didn't know what to do with them, right? That is more of a sign to me that something's going on. So typically I refer individuals to go see their primary care provider to diagnose any type of dementia. We really do need to run a thorough battery of tests. So we do what we call cognitive assessments. We ask people questions to kind of see if they're oriented to place or time. Can they draw a clock and give us the time and them show us where the hands would go, things like that. We ask them to recall things like we give them a list and then ask them 5 minutes later to recall that. In addition to that, there's a lot of blood work that we tend to do to look for things like this as well.
If a person is in your family and they ask you a question, okay, give them the answer. And it won't be 2 seconds later, they're asking you the same question over.
I do that.
Is that something we have to look for?
Yeah, that would be something when you're talking to that person's doctor, you would want to let them know about that. A lot of times what happens is, so sometimes we're not being very mindful. There's also natural, as we get older, we naturally forget some things, right? Even, especially, let me just use this imagery, and I wish I had a picture of this. When I talk about memory, I like to think about memory as being a bookcase, all right? And every time you get a new memory, you put it in a book, and the book goes on the bookshelf. At the top of our bookshelf is usually our oldest memories. So sometimes we can grab from those oldest memories, but we can't grab at the bottom, which is what happened 5 minutes ago. It's a little bit too hard for us to bend down and get that. Even though we can still reach the top, the bottom memories are just not there anymore. Okay? Even though we put them in the book and we've put the book on the shelf, it's just difficult for us to retrieve it. Okay? And so sometimes that's what's happening for the individual. Now, does that always mean they have dementia? No. That's why we like to do blood work as well as doing cognitive tests. There are some medications that people are on that cause short-term memory loss. Sometimes these are medications that maybe they've been on for a really long time. But as we get older, sometimes it's harder for us to metabolize those medications that we were on for 20, 30 years even. And so we get a buildup of them. And so they cause memory issues. So a lot of times with dementia, we're really trying to rule out that it's not something else causing it, unfortunately. Now, there are some fancy schmancy diagnostics that we can do. We in Kentucky don't largely have access to those, quite frankly, because it's a lot more, there's like a dye test that they can run. A lot of times, for a very long time, the only way for us to diagnose Alzheimer's type dementia was to do a autopsy after the person had passed and look at the brain to look for what we call classic signs of dementia, which are plaques and tangles. Now, we're a little bit more savvy than that now. We can do a lot more and pretty definitively say that person has Alzheimer's disease, but it's still a little bit difficult. And so that's why it's so important to go to your doctor and have those conversations and to let them know. Is that helpful, I hope? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
So if 7 hours of sleep is perfect for our God-given bodies, why do our bladders not?
I wish you could tell me that because I have the same problem. That is what, so again, let me just step back and say 7 is what, for most people, is good, right? A lot of times, you know, we are trying to stay hydrated. Kudos to you for that. But that does interrupt our sleep. If that's a problem for you and you're getting up and down, I have to stop drinking water like an hour or two before I go to bed. We were not maybe necessarily meant to drink as much water as we are to stay hydrated. So that's part of it. But I do appreciate that because, yes, that's a problem for a lot of us, I'm sure. I would say, too, I don't know if anybody's ever worked a night shift before in this room. Yeah, a couple people. I worked a night shift, 2 different jobs in my early 20s, where one of them I had to go in at 7 p.m. and I think I got off at 4:30 in the morning. Another job where I worked like a crazy 20-hour shift straight through, where I went in at 5 p.m. and got off at like 9 a.m. the next day or something like that. That pattern for me for a very long time meant that at 2 a.m. I was awake, 3 a.m. I was awake. It took me a very long time to adjust to a normal sleeping. It took me probably 10 years. I wrecked my system for 10 years where I wasn't just waking up in the middle of the night, panic that I was had fallen asleep at work, right? That was like the panic. But yeah, it's one of those things where it takes your body a while to adjust to those changes as well. The other thing is I often get questions about, so yours is a good one, melatonin and other supplements to help you sleep. anytime you're talking about supplements, those are not things we're intended necessarily to take every day for a long time. Any medication, quite frankly, we need to be assessing. But melatonin is great if you have like seven, if you take it for 7 days, get your body used to a good healthy sleep pattern, but then you don't want to keep taking that, right? Because you're kind of over time adding to your sort of overall pill burden if you're having to take other things. Other questions? Yes.
My dad had Alzheimer's, died from that. I didn't realize it when he was diagnosed that there's like 14 different stages that they go through.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it's just that memory loss. It's total to short-term memory to remembering 50 years ago how to speak a language, and then later on not being able to take care of yourself. And not even be able to feed yourself.
Yeah, you're making a very good point about that, and I hope just to make sure everybody heard that. Alzheimer's disease is not just memory loss, right? This is also one of my pet peeves. I didn't even go on this whole thing. But think about your brain as being your sort of the hub of communication for your entire body. So let's say this was a stove, and I put my hand here, right, by accident. It is my brain telling me that is painful and I should remove my hand, right? So that shows you, I think, that it's not just memory. It's also about how your body communicates with itself. So I don't know if you had a question, so I'll let you continue. I just wanted to make sure.
You didn't point out that there's so many different stages that they go through.
Yes. And, different people, it looks very different. I always like to say if you've met one person with dementia, you've met one person with dementia. With my grandmother, who I mentioned when I was seven was diagnosed, she probably passed away about 18 months after she was first diagnosed. I had an aunt who was diagnosed in her, she was probably 57. She passed away about 10 years later. So, I everybody's journey looks a little bit different. With some individuals, we see sort of a rapid kind of progression. With other individuals, we see that they kind of stay in that earlier moderate stage for a really long time, and then at the end we see a rapid sort of decline. So every person looks a little bit different as well because of that. It's very, as from a practitioner provider standpoint, when working with families, it's people always ask what to expect. How long do they have? And it's so difficult to have those conversations because we just don't know. Every person is a little bit different. Yes.
We always hear about it. It's kind of like an old wives' tale. Does completing crossword puzzles really work in battling against Alzheimer's and dementia? Like, is it an effective way to keep your mind?
That's a great question. So, not just crossword puzzles, but there's been a lot of apps developed in the last 10 years, 15 years to help with brain health in general. You'll see a lot of these marketed. Now, those things are great because there's something to do. They're keeping you stimulated. They're kind of tapping into some critical thinking, right? Especially as maybe you're transitioning from working and having to use your brain all the time to retirement, where maybe you're not doing as many cognitively stimulating things. So they are definitely not bad. Now, is that going to just prevent you from getting dementia? Probably not. It's the combination of all of the things that is really helpful. And for a long time, I used to stand up here and say, oh, well, we just don't have the data to kind of show for these things. Crosswords have been around for a really long time, pen and paper-wise, so I don't know why a lot of people weren't doing research on those. But in general, that's just one thing you can do. So they're not bad. They're actually really great and great to keep you kind of stimulated, but that shouldn't be all. You shouldn't hang your hat on just one thing at all when you talk about dementia.
I don't know. Sundays in the New York Times are tough.
Sundays are the hard ones. They always get me with the spelling. Sometimes they combine some words there. It's like, I know that's the answer. Yeah. Great question, though. Other questions? I think we're maybe out of town.
What about Privigen? We hear about
That's a supplement, if you've not heard of it. It is a...
What's your feelings on it?
There's not a lot of evidence to show that it's going to necessarily help. Now, they will tell you otherwise because they try to sell you something. But, again, always be wary of the people who are trying to sell you something. This is not Jack and the Giant Beanstalk or whatever the thing is. There's not a magic sort of thing.
I think the initial evidence with that is to say that, you know, it's not going to hurt you, right? But we don't have a substantial body of evidence to say that's really, really helpful. It's also a supplement. So you have to think that it is long-term. We try not to want you to be on so many medications, right? Because medications can be very difficult as we get older for our body to excrete. So most supplements we end up, you know, peeing out most of them, right? And if we have too much, which is great, our body kind of has like a self-regulation system in that says, oh, you've taken too much of this. We'll get rid of it for you. But over time doing that, it's kind of hard on your kidneys. So taking too many medications, again, has that same kind of effect. But I don't tend to recommend that just because I've not seen the evidence. No one has proven to me that it works 100%. And I'm always going to be very real about those things. I always think people are trying to sell us things. Yeah. Yes. It's expensive too, isn't it, I think? Last time I checked. Yes.
$3,000 in one cup.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
I went to that.
What is it?
Okay, yeah, there's a lot of medications like that can be helpful. Correct. No, it is not, sir. And one of the things too I will say as well, when you talk about medications, a lot of times if you're first diagnosed with any type of what we call mild cognitive impairment or cognitive decline or even a type of dementia, they will prescribe a medication like Aricept. You've probably commonly heard this. And those medications, let me just explain to you, they do have some utility. They can help slow the progression of the disease up to a certain point, but then eventually they just stop working. So you might have a loved one or a friend or a family member who's on Aricept or one of the other medications that's on the market that's FDA approved for Alzheimer's disease. And again, that's a lot of times erroneously people are told that this is going to cure their loved one, or this is going to make it completely better, or oh, they've got dementia and this is going to solve all the problems. And that's not really the truth. It's going to slow the progression, which is amazing because you're going to get more time together or more years together. But eventually, and it doesn't work for everybody. A lot of times people have a lot of side effects associated with it. The other type of medication is what the gentleman in the back is referring to, where we might have a person who's a little aggressive or gets a little upset, or in some situations with different types of dementias, we see people having what we call hallucinations, meaning seeing things that aren't there. With hallucinations, we tend to kind of classify these. If a person's having hallucinations and it's Casper the Friendly Ghost and they're happy to have Casper with them, more power to them. Let them love it. Let them, you know, be happy with Casper. If it is a hallucination that's scary, or they're seeing people who they know are dead, or things like that, where it's causing them a lot of anxiety or distress, we will prescribe a medication in those situations to help with those behaviors to better manage that. But if it's Casper, we tend to just let it grow with it. I once took care of somebody, she's passed away now. She had Parkinsonian dementia, and she had a Casper, the Friendly Ghost, kind of hallucination. And so every night when we were helping her get into bed, we would have to say goodnight to Casper. Casper would say the prayers with us. And so he was quite good. But we didn't really worry about it because it was kind of like a nice, friendly presence for her. Even though it wasn't there, we couldn't see it. That was her world. We were just living in it, and she was happy. So why give somebody a medication and burden them further when it's not really a problem? It's like a child having an imaginary friend. Same concept. Thank you. Thank you all.
If the Rotary Club would, if you would sign on your way out.